Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, although there is no Amy because Amy's not feeling well, so hopefully she'll be okay. Yeah, she's going to take a COVID test and we'll find out, remembering that she is vaxxed, but I digress. So we'll keep you updated on her health and hopefully she'll be fine and back tomorrow or shortly thereafter. Yesterday, Mayor Triple Threat took to CNBC's Squawk Box to talk about the vax mandate that went into effect yesterday for businesses, health clubs, and so on and so forth. Not airports, not places of worship, not grocery stores, because not retail outlets, because we know, again, that COVID respects the Louis Vuitton store, respects the Jewel. It doesn't spread there, so no need for mandates there, just mandates and the selected places, the arbitrary places that the politicians, the lockdowners like Lightfoot, suggest will slow the spread, stop the spread, eliminate COVID, keep people safe, save lives, and so forth. In point of fact, businesses who are operating under this mandate in Chicago are thankful. Thank you, Triple Threat.
And what we're hearing from a lot of folks, particularly business people, is they want to create a safe environment, and they're grateful for us imposing this vaccine mandate in entertainment venues, so restaurants, bars, gyms, and the like.
They're grateful. Thank you for imposing the mandate. Maybe some of these sycophants in the trade association world, like Sam Toya at the Illinois Restaurant Association, maybe they are thankful, because they're influence peddlers who just want to sidle up to who's ever in power for their own particular benefit, even if it's to the detriment of the entities, the individuals, the businesses they purport to represent. Businesses are thankful. Does that square with logic? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36DA, turnkey.pro text line. They're thankful that Triple Threat is creating a safe environment. You know, I'm try to go back to sort of the basics of economics, because the basics of economics are the basics of human interaction. People respond to incentives, and so the incentives you present in a competitive environment, you can predict how people will react. And you can also see what the opportunities are. So, again, what businesses, health clubs, restaurants, bars, and the like, what they were waiting for the last year and a half plus, is for the city to come in and create a safe environment in their place of business. Really. So if creating a safe environment in the COVIDian definition, with a hat tip to the pandemicists, if creating that safe environment so that the ignorant and the cowardly would patronize their establishment, if that was what they were waiting for all this time, why didn't they do it themselves? Why wouldn't businesses do it themselves? Why wouldn't they say, you know what my competitive advantage is going to be in this sector that I operate in, or in this city that I operate in? I'm going to be the one that says, hey, to come into my establishment, I want to see a vax pass. Anyone five and over, or whatever age you so decree, you could have decreed per what was approved at whatever point in time you picked over the last 2 years. Why wouldn't you say, I'm going to do it? That's what's going to separate me from the other bars and restaurants. And some were essentially doing that in Chicago. So let that reign if this is about helping business. Of course it's not. This is about imposing will. It's something else that just strikes me, too, thinking about the concern that these preening pandemicists have for the human condition. You're going to help businesses that don't need your help. If they wanted to do this, they could do this, right? It's private property. No shoes, no shirt, no service, no shoes, no shirt, no vax pass, no service. You could do that. Chose not to. Why? So why are they thankful? Because of what everybody's on the level playing field? Well, if this is what you were waiting for, then why didn't you do it yourself? Why do you need Lightfoot to come in? The other thing is, since the mantra now has changed from preventing vaccinations prevent you from being infected or transmitting to prevent serious illness, then who are you trying to protect? You're trying to protect the knuckle-dragging unvaccinated? Really? Do you believe that a triple threat is mainly concerned about saving the lives of people who've chosen not to get the unvaccinated? These are the same people being demonized, by the way, from the beginning to the present. Got to get more people vaccinated. You got to get vaccinated. Everything is get vaccinated. Because they have so much concern about the unvaccinated. The super spreaders, the people that are perpetuating the pandemic as they've so been described. But they're so concerned about saving their lives for them. Is that credible? Does that follow logically from the other rhetoric you hear from these same COVIDians? I don't think so. So there's something else afoot. Of course there is. Oh, and by the way, it's certainly not to stop the spikes. We know that from New York, as Triple Threat was reminded by CBS, the CNBC anchor with whom she was speaking. You know, we're here in New York. We've had the vax pass. Yeah, it's incentivized more people to get vaccinated because they figure path of least resistance. I want to go out and enjoy the health club, enjoy the restaurant, enjoy a Broadway show, whatever. So they've done it. But it's not presenting the spike here. We've got more cases per capita than you do in Chicago. And her response.
Chicago, for example, you know, do you really think this is going to stop your caseload from approaching on a percentage basis what we've seen in New York?
What I think it's going to do is compel people to get vaccinated. What we're seeing is the overwhelming majority of people that are in non-ICU beds, ICU beds, and unfortunately who are dying, are they unvaccinated? It's not even a close call. So if we can get a significant percentage of people to get vaccinated because they want to take advantage of restaurants, bars, gyms, and the like, we will have done a lot of good to save lives. And that is absolutely worth it.
Do you believe her? Do you believe that's her motivation? Is to save the lives of the slow learners, according to them, the unvaccinated. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Greg, Rogers Park.
Good morning. Happy New Year, Dan. Dan, you got a great show. Dan, number one, what happens between you and your healthcare professional is between you two, I thought, and it's none of their business. Two, she doesn't care. These are evil people. I have one of the worst older persons ever in Maria Hyden up here. She is really the worst of the worst. She's a Marxist communist. All she wants to do is purge her control on people. And three, these people don't give a darn. They're just trying to hurt business. No one's going to help stop the spread with this. It's all a bunch of lies, communist, Marxist garbage. And I hope we go to court and put an end to this nonsense.
Thanks for the call, Greg. Mike Plano.
Hey, Dan, you know these restaurateurs you're talking about? These are the same people that when they were just days away from going under were begging Lori Lightfoot to let them open up at 20% capacity, mm-hmm. which wouldn't have got them out of their financial troubles, not even close. So this isn't an authoritative group we're dealing with here. And I want to know why, how Chicago has gotten away with for so long of being this city of tough guys, blue collar, work hard, play hard. I mean, you look at these people, they're total simps and sloths and scaredy cats. It's pathetic.
Yeah, thanks for the call, Mike. That's a city of big shoulders. That city's gone, as far as I can tell. I mean, somebody please feel free to correct the record. That city is gone. It's a city of rent seekers. Big shoulders, work hard, play hard. That's all, you know, maybe that was reflective of a sensibility in Chicago a few generations ago. Today? You can't be serious. Ron, Salem, Wisconsin.
Hey, good morning, Dan. It's definitely not the city I grew up in. I have a question for you after my statement. My little sister works in the liquor industry in Chicago, and she says every restaurant that she goes into, the owners tell her that Beetlejuice can man the door herself if she wants.
Mm-hmm.
The question I had for you is, I'm hearing that, true or false, I'm hearing that the vaccinated are the most that are dying in the hospitals in Illinois. Is that true?
Thanks for the call, Ron. No, that's not true, not on the most recent data I've seen. But, you know, we talked about this a bit before the holidays. You know, there was this is national data. And for like the last 7-day rolling average that we talked about at the time, now this is a couple weeks old, and there's lag on this. But let's just take, I just repeat this for the context that you don't get anywhere else, so the response can be proportional. Unvaccinated to vaccinated, the deaths were roughly running a little less than 4 to a little bit more than 1. So let's call it 4 to 1 to be generous to the pandemicists. 4 to 1 unvaccinated to vaccinated. So, you know, 4 times the rate among the unvaccinated. Yeah, but there's context here. This is like we're saying, you know, if you, whatever the latest study is on red wine, it does or does not prevent heart disease. The new study out that says drinking 1 glass of red wine a day can reduce your chance of heart disease by 20%. Yeah, but what's the 20%? So let's just, this is hypothetical and it's not scientific. I'm just using this for illustrative purposes. So if I drink 1 glass of red wine a day, my risk of heart disease goes from 5 to 4. In other words, 5 in 100,000 to 4 in 100,000. Well, that's what you have with COVID deaths. Because remember what the survival rate is overall among those under 60 in the 99th percentile. So that's 4 deaths per 100,000 as compared to 1 death per 100,000. So the chances of death are still infinitesimal. Are they more pronounced among the unvaccinated than the vaccinated? That's what the data indicates. Now, that also doesn't contemplate, which is why I think that number is a little smaller, the other issue, which is the number of deaths that are correlated and possibly caused by taking the vaccine. But we don't even have to contemplate that. You just say that, you know, there are other variables that could close that gap further. But just operating from that gap, 4 to 1, 4 in 100,000 to 1 in 100,000. And then you contemplate these other variables, these other risk factors to say, is there really any significant upside for me? Not to mention, now I'm sort of dug in because of the imperious nature of these COVIDians. That's the conversation that the rational person has that's looking for information and trying to process this in a way that's serves their best interest, which, oh, by the way, is how all medical decisions should be made by the individual, for the individual's best interests, not some sort of abstract notion of community good, as phony as that is, particularly from those who prattle on endlessly about community good. That's the context that's missing, in addition to so much other context that's missing and continues to be purposely withheld to obfuscate Wear your mask. Oh, is there a difference between cloth masks and N95 masks? Well, sure there is. We don't care. We just want your mask on. We just want you vaccinated. Well, what if it doesn't do anything? What if it doesn't accomplish the ends that you are saying it will accomplish? Doesn't matter. Just do it. From the beginning to the present, from the lockdowners. And you attempt to raise questions about efficacy, like, say, the Great Barrington Declaration, public health professionals and medical doctors did. And then you have the cabal turn on you and try to sideline any sort of dissent, discussion, substantive questions. And that's where we're at 2 years in, year three, AC after COVID.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper, hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Amy off today. She's not feeling well, so hopefully she'll be feeling better and back soon. We'll keep you updated on that, of course. Before the break, before Mike Scott's newscast, we were talking about Mayor Triple Threat's interview on CNBC's Squawk Box yesterday, regaling the audience with how thankful Chicago businesses are for her Vax Pass mandate. That she is focused on saving lives, apparently of the unvaxxed, because the talking point is still that if you're vaccinated, your serious illness slash death is effectively prevented. So really concerned about the unvaccinated, if you believe that. She also addressed what is coming today, which is the Chicago Teachers Union is voting on whether or not to stay on the job or walk out, because they would prefer to do remote learning rather than in-person instruction. And when it comes to the Chicago Teachers Union, you can be certain that they will try to make learning as remote a possibility as they can. So this vote today, having toddlers vote on, as to whether or not they want ice cream. Gee, I wonder which way this is going to go with CTU today. So you may have a walkout. We'll see. In New York, you have the teachers suing for at least 2 weeks of remote learning, you know, of course, to follow the example that's the wonderful example that's being set by all of our institutions of higher education, like the Ivy League schools or the University of Illinois. Mm-hmm. Here's what Triple Threat had to say about the prospect of a shutdown altogether, lockdown 2.0 formally, as opposed to this informal backdoor lockdown with the mandates.
Look, my goal is to make sure that we never shut down again. It was devastating on our economy, on small business people, on employees. If we have to do that, certainly I'm not going to take that off the table. But my goal is that we never get to that place. And regarding schools, let me say this. One of the things that doesn't get reported on in coverage of saber rattling by teachers union leadership is the devastating effect that remote learning had on our children and on their families. We know that learning loss was profound. We know that there were huge gaps in achievement. We know that the mental health and trauma issues of our students was real. And we know that it was devastating for families, particularly those families where the parents couldn't afford not to work. So there's a lot of different component parts that go into it. But fundamentally, we know our schools are safe. Our schools are not the source of significant spread. The issue is community spread. But we need to keep our kids in schools, which is what we're going to do in Chicago.
It's amazing. Other than keeping the prospect of lockdowns on the table, Triple Threat sounds like me. She sounds like what I've been saying for, I don't know, since the summer of 2020. Oh, really? This is, you know, just another classic case of the way Chicago Democrat socialists communicate. The dissociative, the purposeful dissociative episode. These lockdowns, the school closures were terrible on the kids. The retardation of educational attainment and intellectual development, the mental health issues. Yeah. Could you refresh our recollection, Triple Threat? Who imposed the lockdown? Who sent the kids home? It was such a burden on parents who aren't in a position to choose not to work or to work from a laptop. Right. Yeah. She sounds like what sensible people who live in a world of trade-offs were, and who are expressing skepticism about lockdowns if the purpose was to prevent transmission. What did we find out? Transmission mainly occurred in homes. She sounds like what we've been saying for the better part of a year and a half. But lockdowns are still on the table. Let me ask a question. When, if ever, will lockdowns be off the table? What is, this is a Tony, you know, sort of a Tony Fauci question. I know the number's going to move around depending on what is in your political interest at the time the question is asked. What's the magic number of the vaccinated and boosted where you say lockdowns are off the table? How de minimis does the impact of the virus need to be as compared to other seasonal viruses before you say lockdowns are off the table? Or, as I said yesterday, are we just going to, you know, get everything we can out of Omicron and then come late February, maybe early March, then we'll turn our attention to that Flurona virus, that Flurona iteration that Israel has discovered over the weekend, the combination of flu and corona, and we'll lose our minds over that. And we'll have to consider lockdowns and go through these same machinations that we're going through again with Omicron, like we did Delta, like we did with the original. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Love to hear from CPS parents. I don't know what more there is to offer on CPS, which is, I mean, as I've said before the pandemic, is nothing more than a criminal enterprise that should be prosecuted under RICO, organized to defraud children of their education and education, the opportunity to earn an education. That's what CPS is and continues to be. A system set up for the benefit and convenience of adults. To the extent that any child, I will repeat it till my dying breath, to the extent that, or until there's transformative change, to the extent that any child is educated in CPS, it is entirely a function of their parents, full stop, combined with teachers at schools that have accountability to parents. And that's very few of them in CPS, isn't it? $9 billion a year to send what? One in 12 kids to a BA by the time they're 25? You're telling me that you couldn't take that $9 billion, shut down the school system altogether, distribute the money. It's not about money. Distribute the same amount of money to the same people, maybe means tested a little bit, and say, here's a pot of money with which to educate your kid through high school. And you'd get worse results than CPS produces? Not possible. Not possible. The opportunity for a school choice, expanded school choice discussion in Chicago right now, as with the last 2 years, and it's being largely missed by whatever's left of conservative reformers and the Republican Party in the state. Not to mention the particularly Black and, to a lesser extent, Latino identitarians who clearly have no conscience. So lockdowns are not off the table. And you just got through telling us about the deleterious effects of lockdowns. Oh, by the way, including not just educational, not just mental health, including physical health. of the 600 or so, this is a new study from CDC, 61% of teenagers hospitalized for COVID-19 had severe obesity. A study of 915 children hospitalized found that most involved underlying conditions, with childhood obesity being far and away the most common element. 600 Americans under the age of 18 have died of COVID during the pandemic. CDC took a closer look at young people hospitalized for COVID in July and August, largely found that healthy young people continue to mostly evade the worst of COVID-19, but those who were teenagers and who were obese represented the small fraction of that overall population that suffered serious illness. And I'm sorry, you want to contemplate remote learning? I know Lightfoot is making noise about not doing that and, you know, trying to position herself against the teachers union. Remember, there is no white hats in this story. Just black hats, or in Lightfoot's case, green hats. You know, the census cowboy and her census cowboy friend. So you want to restrict the movement of people and children when you know that there's huge weight gains among the populace generally, including kids, and you're going to have them less mobile than they would otherwise be if we decided to return to something approximating a free society with free movement and things like athletics and extracurriculars where you weren't masked up and you weren't creating hurdles for participation. I mean, that the whole thing is oxymoronic with an emphasis on moronic. Mark and Rochelle, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, you switched to the CDC topic. I was just on the website last week. I'm curious. I wanted to see what are the actual death numbers for COVID. And it was somewhere around 700,000 for COVID. But there was 700,000 from pneumonia, and there was 1.1 million deaths from COVID and the flu. So I don't know why we don't speak of those numbers. And another thought I had was about why are they really coming down on small business or businesses in general. I think before COVID, 64% of the people in the United States were employed by small business. So what better way to get in and control that population? And large businesses, like large corporations, can survive this better than small businesses because they have more ability to comply. So those are a couple thoughts I had this morning.
Thanks for the call, Mark. Greg in LaGrange.
Hey, how you doing, Dan? To Lightfoot's point, it's not about caring about anything except for power and keeping power. She's just starting to hear that some liberal commentators are coming out and mentioning children are suffering and all of this, and it sounds good. It makes her appeal to more people like she cares. Back to the city thing.
And also, I mean, sorry to interrupt, but just for emphasis, it also is a way for her to absolve herself of responsibility for the infliction of that suffering. Now, she's relying on people's short-term memory loss to forget that these were what she's describing are the results of decisions she and those disposed like her made.
Absolutely. It comes back to the old Iraqi war thing. When it turns out that it may not have been a good idea or it was not a good idea, everybody says, well, everybody voted for it. It's like you herd yourself into the entire group and said, you know what? We learned from this. I don't believe it. Johan Gusecki showed what kind of statistics we have with children in Sweden early on. It's a joke. Kids are being destroyed. As for the businesses in this city, all it is about bellying up to the trough. If they're worried about safety, they're concerned about safety. What about the safety of the patrons on the street or their property rights as they get vandalized? It's not about safety. It's about bellying up to the trough and being weak and getting what you can get in a handout and getting special favors. You know, this whole thing about Chicago, the tough city, everybody's just, you know, with the fedoras on and just nose to the grindstone, reminds me of nothing more than the line from Liberty Valance: when the legend becomes fact, print the legend.
Right.
Over.
Thanks, Greg. Dr. Yerkes in Oak Lawn.
Right. Hi, good morning, Dan. I went downtown Chicago yesterday, January 3rd, to peacefully protest the tyranny of Lori Lightfoot and J.B. Pritzker. Dan and Amy, America is not free unless we the people can speak freely. I have natural immunity. Why are we being discriminated against? No lockdowns, no Lightfoot. Your thoughts?
Thanks for the call, Doc. Yeah, I mean, yeah. No disagreement. David in Lansing.
Good morning, Dan. I have two comments. First is about Mayor Pugface. May I call her that?
I did.
You mentioned that she's pretending to care about the unvaccinated. Well, she really is, because by not allowing the unvaccinated to go to work, she's forcing them to move out of state where they will be safer, away from gunfire and so forth. The second comment is, you just kind of triggered this in my mind with this flu coronavirus discovery. How do we know that China isn't releasing new variants on purpose? Thereby working with Pfizer and others that are making money off of this. That's just a food for thought question.
Thanks for the call, David. Matt, Mount Greenwood.
Hi, Dan. I just want to talk real quickly. I was talking to a friend of mine who's a small business. He owns a lumber yard, a home center, several of them. But the point being is that we were talking last evening. He said that these big box stores are cornering the market, the corporatists. They are actually, what they're doing is they're making their money on rebates off the manufacturers, and small suppliers, electrical suppliers in particular, are getting hammered by this. So there and again, they don't care about small business because they're getting their monies from the corporatists. So have a good day, Dan. Thanks.
Thanks for the comment. I mean, it's a great point. And here again, the ugly specter of politics insinuates itself. What a surprise. Everything is political. Everything is political with these people. And what's the constituency they're serving? Big business. And who is big business a coalition partner? You know, in whose coalition is big business a partner? The Democrat Socialists. These rent seekers. That doesn't say every big business is bad or every big business is a rent seeker. There are some out there. There are some Hank Reardons out there that are the heads of big businesses that usually started out as small businesses, and they're the founders of those small businesses that turned into big businesses. You know, Bernie Marcus comes to mind, for example. But yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. The party, the Democrat Socialists, right? The party of the proletariat, to use their nomenclature. No, they never have been in all of the iterations of Marxism throughout the annals of history, and they aren't today. They're the party of centralization, which demands consolidation. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer
on AM 560, The Answer.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. The tale of two schools and a larger culture. And I'm not just talking about Chicagoland, but certainly Chicagoland is a good example of a bad example. Bennett Academy, where I went to high school. Oak Park River Forest. The former private Catholic. The latter public government. Updating the Bennett Academy story. From last year that we talked about on this show, they hired a female lacrosse coach, the head of the girls lacrosse team at Bennett Academy, who is gay, Amanda Camus. And that's a problem because it runs afoul of the character statement as outlined in Bennett Academy's parental handbook, same-sex couple. Catholic Church doesn't recognize marriage redefinition. It's a problem. She indicated her partner on her job application, and so it compelled the school to make a determination, What did the school do? Well, the board decided that the politics of the day is more important than their alleged enduring faith. Pope Francis, on marriage redefinition, anthropological regression is what he terms it. You know, the Pope that the social justice Catholics, which is to say the anti-Catholic Catholics, celebrate as not Catholic or as cafeteria Catholic like they are. Not even really cafeteria Catholic, ornamental Catholic. Grandma and grandpa were Catholic. Mom and dad were Catholic. They used to take me to church. So technically I'm Catholic, but I'm not, you know, particularly serious about it. I mean, if I come up with an idea or I'm wooed by an idea that runs afoul of the catechism, well, so be it. I mean, I'm my own God, so I make those decisions. And I'll still, you know, make overtures, paeans to the ornamentation of Catholic because it may serve my interests. But that's all it's for, serving my interests. I'm not here to serve anybody else's interests, particularly the church or by extension, the God in whom I supposedly believe. No, I'm here to serve my interests. I'm God. Right. And so the faith and the faith-infused education at Bet Academy shunted aside to make sure we're all celebrating the identitarian politics of the day. Well, they're still Benedictine, the Order of St. Benedict, involvement in the school. And as I understand it today, there will be a joint statement issued by the board at Benedict Academy, which is a board appointed by the Benedictines. They actually have authority, plenary authority over the school and the board. It's appointed board. This isn't like a government school system where you put it to a vote of the district. A joint statement will be issued today that the Benedictines are leaving the school. Bye-bye. Because apparently, the monks weren't up for the fight. They won't replace a few egomaniacal board members who usurped the authority of the Benedictines to play politics. So there goes Benedict Academy on the altar of identity politics. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. The chairman of the board of Bennett is a 1960 grad of the school named Dennis Flynn. You can go to Bennett Academy, Bennett.org's website, and look up the board members if you want. If you care to make any, if you're a Bennett Academy or Catholic, Bennett Academy alum, parent, family, Catholic, you care about Catholic education in what was one of the really very best high schools in Illinois. I know when this issue of the lacrosse coach came up, the identitarians, the Marxists, the liberation theologists, now we call them social justice warriors within the Catholic community, they petitioned the board. Well, they did more than that. If you recall our coverage, I had the spreadsheet of the call list. They were threatening board members with respect to their businesses, those who had businesses in DuPage County or in the area, and otherwise putting pressure on them to fold, because that's what you're supposed to do when you have a couple of identitarians on the board and you have a couple of gay Bennett alums who want to see this happen because, you know, their feelings are more important than the faith. So that's where it's at. It was an opportunity. There was an opportunity. A path could have been chosen. And the chancellor there is Abbot Austin Murphy. He's a Benedictine. Path could have been chosen. Say, well, I'm just going to replace the board. Could have exercised power in his possession. But he won't. He's not going to, per this joint statement that's coming today, as I understand it. So understand the dynamic here. An appointed board exercise power they don't have, and the religious order won't exercise power it does have. And you are confused as to how things got the way they are and why we can't make it stop and concerned about where this is all going. Oh, it's not worth a fight. I like the lacrosse coach. She may be a lovely person. I don't know her. Not the point. Oh, you know, we need to be tolerant. This is not about tolerance. It's about the faith. It's about the faith-infused education at the institution, something that endures the politics of the day, if it's going to mean anything at all. Nope. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. This is a momentous mistake by the Benedictines and a real abdication of moral authority. It's sad. It's sad when a school that has produced so many great people who have done so many great things as such an institution in DuPage County is torn asunder from within, where there are people that could do something about it, but not worth it. And I'm talking about the lay board members as well as the Benedictines. The Benedictines sort of have a storied place in world history, too, in and outside of the church, in terms of saints and martyrs and men of principle. Where are they today? Well, when does it become okay? When is it time to do the right thing? I'm confused. I'm as confused as anybody. Can somebody tell me when it's time to do the right thing? When it's time to stand on the side of truth? Because I know it's not when the kids are in school, because, you know, you don't want to get them in trouble with the teacher. I know it's not before the kids are in school because you want them to get into the school. I know it's not when they're applying for a job because you want them to get the job. I know it's not when you're in the job because you don't want them to get fired and negatively impact their career. So when is it time to do the right thing? When is it time to be who you say you are? I don't know. I don't know anymore. Government school system. Oak Park River Forest. So listen up, all of you geldings in Oak Park and River Forest. A lot of erstwhile conservative guys, successful guys, at least in River Forest. You know, fewer, more of the Birkenstock soy boy crowd, even the, and as soy boys, I include the, you know, perpetual hippies held over from the 60s, too. But in River Forest, there's a lot of professionals. There used to be. I mean, they're moving out. Captains of industry. Rich folk. In a new book aimed at educators, Oak Park and River Forest High School Superintendent Gregory Johnson describes how he has struggled to do his job amidst the, quote, powerful presence of whiteness and white racism in Oak Park and River Forest. Gregory Johnson, you won't be surprised, is a pasty white guy. The powerful presence of whiteness and white racism that inhibits his ability to do his job as superintendent of OPRF. Mm-hmm. He published comments in a book, Strengthening Anti-Racist Educational Leaders. Mm-hmm. He writes in that book, Oak Park and River Forest were the precarious socio-political context where he had to navigate the political tightrope of being anti-racist in values and actions while simultaneously wrestling with the powerful presence of whiteness and white racism in the district community. Leaders need to understand how whiteness and white supremacy operate within the current educational policy agenda, because only then will they be prepared to upend white racism's efforts to impede their anti-racist policy aims and actions. Public education is an agent of whiteness, writes Superintendent Johnson. Education as an institution was inherently orchestrated to exclude people of color to further the accumulation of white constituents' privileges and opportunities within the educational system. This white supremacy in education is also linked to white accumulated privileges in other societal institutions, which advance white supremacy. Whiteness also survives and thrives by delaying and often derailing any progress toward righting racial wrongs in educational policy. As he described his, quote, struggle to manage the political pushback, i.e. whiteness, from white stakeholders who are concerned with how this leveling in the playing field may take away educational privileges they have long grown accustomed to and expect. Only by understanding how whiteness operates can leaders then ensure that it does not distract from their key purpose, which is systemic anti-racist action. That's the key purpose of leaders in K through 12 education. He goes on. The fear of black and brown students existing in spaces that has been largely populated by white students became monetized. Moreover, the color-evasive discourse used both in person and through anonymous letters demonstrates the pervasiveness of whiteness in education and who, white students, should be afforded opportunity. Oak Park River Forest. Same question as I posed to the Bennett Academy community. When do you stand up for what you know to be true? When do you stop being pushed around by your taxpayer-funded school superintendent calling you all white supremacists? Are you that weak? Are you that feeble? When is it time to say something? When is it time to do something consistent with who you say you are? You don't care? It doesn't matter? Just trying to get my kids out and then on to the next thing? I'm going to capitulate here so that we can capitulate somewhere else later? And then we wonder why there's no electoral competition in the region or the state. Because that's exactly what the Republican Party has done for the last 40 years, which is why it doesn't exist. That's why this is a failed state. So running around decrying political leaders who behave the same way you do, why wouldn't they? They're just reflective of the culture they see before them. This is where I got to be to maintain my sinecure, just like everybody else maintains theirs. When is it time? Give me a place. Give me an example. Bennett goes away. I mean, effectively, as a serious institution of education. Oak Park River Forest is a catastrophe. Why? Because Superintendent Johnson and his identitarian brethren have turned it into, you know, an outpost of ACORN or Black Lives Matter. Pick your Marxist organization. Pick your favorite Marxist organization. That's what these schools are. But still not time, because that community has a status. The school has a status. And I'm talking about both, OPRF and Bennett. The great people once went there, and they went on to do great things, which gives the school status. And that status helps me feel like I have status, and helps my kid leverage that status for money, really. Because what else are we talking about? We're not talking about character formation. We're not talking about leadership. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Ken in Plainfield.
Yeah, I graduated from Bennett in 1980. I certainly am not the poster child of a graduate because I'm blue-collar worker truck driver, but I was proud to say I graduated from Bennett, and that pretty much ends. And it pretty much follows the whole trail of Catholicism. I mean, at one point in my church, I applied for a deacon, got turned down probably because I am a truck driver, even though I think the Catholics shouldn't turn down any help. And now I'm thinking, they say God moves in mysterious ways. It was probably for the betterment, because I would be the guy saying, hey, this is wrong. You know, Bennett's a Catholic school. They have Catholic tenets. And now they might as well just, you know, pull the charter and name it, you know, Lyle Senior High too. Because as far as I'm concerned, you know, there's no morality left there. And for the abbot, you know, to give up that easily, I remember the abbots, you know, this is showing how old I am. I'm almost 60. I couldn't, you know, picture Father Ron or some of the people, Father Hugh, that I grew up with, putting up with this crap. You know, they didn't really put up with my crap when I was a student.
Mm-hmm. Which is why it was the school it was. Thanks for the call, Ken. Father Ron was there when I was there. Yeah. Gone. A few iconoclastic, egomaniacal board members and a women's lacrosse coach, and the school collapses in on itself. Because nobody wants to do anything. Nobody who actually has power even wants to do anything. You can't do that. Well, you know, what can anybody do? We have people, men of the cloth, in power, who won't do anything. And talk about a sad commentary in the Catholic Church, from the sex abuse scandal to the complete abdication of the catechism. And what about in River Forest? It was a better town when the mobsters lived there. Ron and Carol Stream.
Hey, Dan. Let us know where Amy is. I didn't hear it. But anyway,
She's sick. She'll be back. She's all right.
Oh, okay, great. What are we waiting for? All I can say is the longer we wait, the worse it's going to be. I don't know what's going to happen, but this is a powder keg. I'm sure most sane people realize that. And I don't know what we're waiting for. We can't wait. It's going to be ugly no matter what. The longer we wait, the worse it'll be. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I'm in complete agreement. Thanks for the call, Ron. I just want to know when it is that we're supposed to finally stand up and be who we say we are. It's a complicated question, even that's belied by its simplicity, I suppose. But I think the silence on that, the fact that that question is not being asked, and the fact that it's so difficult to come up with an answer, speaks to where we're at. The answer is never. Not in the culture today. In the culture today, we're supposed to cede our sovereignty for money. We're supposed to cede our morality for money. We're supposed to cede our children's education for money. And status, you know, these materialistic things, which is what? Materialism is, fill in the blank, the foundation of Marxism.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Your show keeps me alive during the week. There's nobody I'd rather listen to between 5 and 9 in the morning than you guys.
On AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis was on with Sean Hannity last night. We're talking about AOC's little vacay in Miami Beach, first and foremost, but more importantly, talking about this successful setup in Florida of mobile units providing monoclonal antibodies to the COVID sick, a therapeutic that has shown great results in treating people that are infected. First on AOC, a little fun. since he was being excoriated for, you know, being absent without leave from his post as governor, when in point of fact he was attending chemo treatments for his wife, with his wife, who is battling breast cancer. But, of course, you know, those sort of details are irrelevant because Ron DeSantis is a bad man, according to the D.C. press corps and their Democrat socialists they serve. But AOC's a little trip to Miami Beach, proposing lockdowns in the Bronx and everywhere else while she enjoys mask-free, vax-mandate-free, living it up in Miami Beach at a coffee shop or at a bar dancing with trannies.
And I can tell you, when you have people like that congresswoman who rip Florida because we're open, who say you need lockdown policies, and then the first chance they get, they come running down to my state. If I had a dollar for every lockdown politician that's done that over the last 2 years, I'd be awfully wealthy right now.
Yeah. You'd be awfully wealthy if you had a dollar just for every Pritzker that has done that, every Pritzker family member that's done that, less AOC. On the more important topic of the monoclonal antibodies, it was going well in Florida. Ron DeSantis had moved to use state resources to purchase the monoclonal antibodies to serve, to stock these mobile units to serve Florida residents. And then the federal government got involved.
We saw when we put in our sites this summer in Florida to deal with the Delta wave, we kept tens of thousands of people out of the hospital. We saved thousands of lives by providing that treatment. So that should have been replicated in all these other states. But instead, what Biden and his cronies have done, they've seized control of all the monoclonal antibodies. So yes, when we were in the pinch, I bought some myself. None of the governors now are able to do that because the feds have seized control. So we're in a situation where we've now asked for 40,000 more every week because I have people that I could help, and they are holding on to it, and they're not distributing it the way we need it to be distributed.
Oh, gosh, government rationing when it comes to health care. When did we have that discussion? Oh, that's right, Obamacare or Medicare or Medicaid. Health insurance companies that ration health care. Right. The question is not whether something that is in limited supply will be rationed. The question is, who will be the rationer? Will it be an exchange that is mutually agreeable between provider and patron? Or will it be one size fits all and the wonders of central planning? And so, as with Obamacare, now we're seeing this with effective therapeutics like monoclonal antibodies, DeSantis continued.
We could scale up to 2 to 3 times the number of treatments that they're sending us, and we could make those readily available. We've asked them to do that. We have sites that will be turned on, additional sites, within less than 24 hours if they send us the medication. And so we're asking them to send it to us. We know it will help people. And the fact
and
of the matter is
no
they've
shortage.
Had a lot of time to plan for this
you
wave.
You talked to the producer of Regeneron.
We don't
is
know
there,
that. Well, the federal government says there's no shortage. But if there's not, then why are they not sending what these people
exactly.
need? I think they may have not purchased enough. And I think that's probably the root of why they're being so scarce with it.
All right. Imagine that, resource misallocation, erroneous forecasts of what the resource needs will be by the central planners, our betters who know everything. Those men and women in D.C. that, you know, turn all the knobs and pull all the levers just so to improve your life. Something about the founders in the 50 laboratories of democracy keeps coming to mind as we see experiments in representative republicanism, small r, going very differently depending on your locale and your state, don't we? But you see, there's a significant portion of the population that doesn't have the ability to contemplate any of these things. They have the ability only to focus on whatever is being said by those who get to say it most often and with the biggest blowtorches behind what they're saying. And this was part of the conversation we wanted to get to yesterday that Joe Rogan had on his podcast with Dr. Robert Malone, who is credited as one of the originators of mRNA vaccines. We've had him on the show before, and he is also a part of a consortium of some 15,000 plus doctors the world over and public health professionals speaking out about these central planned follies in public health in the West in particular, and of course being marginalized, banned, having their licenses threatened for doing so, for running afoul of COVID orthodoxy as it relates to those who have the platforms to repeat their mantras, however contradictory, the most times with the most reach behind them through institutions like the DC Press Corps. And this is endangering not just the here and now and people deciding how best to live during the COVID era, but the quality of public health going forward. Dr. Malone.
Medicine is being destroyed globally. People are losing faith in the whole system. They're losing faith in the scientific enterprise. They're losing faith in our government. They're losing faith in the vaccine enterprise. I mean, what is going to be the long-term consequences of public health when you have a large fraction of the population who wasn't anti-vaxxer, that pejorative, before, that are now saying, oh, my God, if this is how these people make decisions, I don't want anything to do with it. I certainly don't want it jabbed into my kid.
And then he goes on to talk about this concept called mass formation psychosis. And this is what was getting around over the last several days to explain sort of what's happening within a significant percentage of the population, such that their ability to reason has been disabled. Mass formation psychosis, it's a theory advanced, at least Malone gives the credit to Matthias Desmet, who is at the University of Ghent. But, I mean, this is not new. We've referenced this book before, as have other commentators. I mean, go back 170 years to Charles McKay's Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds. This is a psychological phenomenon, a folie du, you know, shared delusion. There are many theorists who have described what we're seeing play out with COVID. And Desmet is among the scholars that looked at this, with the example being the madness of the Germans in the run-up to and through World War II.
This comes from basically European intellectual inquiry into what the heck happened in Germany in the 20s and 30s. You know, very intelligent, highly educated population, and they went barking mad. And how did that happen? The answer is mass formation psychosis. When you have a society that has become decoupled from each other and has free-floating anxiety and a sense that things don't make sense, we can't understand it, and then their attention gets focused by a leader or a series of events on one small point, just like hypnosis, they literally become hypnotized and can be led anywhere. And one of the aspects of that phenomena is the people that they identify as their leaders, the ones typically that come in and say, you have this pain and I can solve it for you. I and I alone, okay, can fix this problem for you. Okay, then they will lead, they will follow that person through, it doesn't matter whether they lie to him or whatever. The data are irrelevant. And furthermore, anybody who questions that narrative is to be immediately attacked. They are the other. This is central to mass formation psychosis.
Gosh, who could he be describing? to play out this theory or to apply a cast to this theory. How about Louis Fauci the 14th? L'état, c'est moi, I am the state, Louis the 14th, Tony Fauci, I am science. To question me, to attack me, is to attack science. Tony Fauci's words, repeatedly, intermittently over the last 2 years. I am science. To attack me is to attack science. Being led by Tony Fauci. And so, how do we get out of this? Of course, the question we've been asking for some time. Oh, what is, and even forget, we were asking it prospectively, you know, what is the exit? Now we're asking it like real time, like how do we get out of this like right now? Not so easy. And Dr. Malone has an answer, but it's a pretty gooey one. It's hard to get your arms around.
And we have to heal ourselves. And one of the things we have to do is come together. We have to recreate our social bonds. We have to buy into integrity, the importance of human dignity, and the importance of community. That's how we get out of this.
Well, okay. And how do we affect that? That's not a simple trick. Come together with integrity and respect for human dignity. Those are easy things to say. They're very difficult things to create, it would seem, wouldn't it? And by the way, just consistent with that theory of mass formation psychosis that he was describing, there's a study out of McGill University up in the strange Brewland. The McGill University team working with the Montreal Neurological Institute Hospital, surveying more than 1,500 Americans to see how pandemic fears affected their thinking. And what they find, for the tasks they made people go through to make these assessments is secondary. I won't get into those details. But what they find is the people experiencing higher levels of pandemic-related worry, free-floating anxiety, as Dr. Malone called it, have lower information processing speed, less ability to retain important information, higher degree of sensitivity to the odds that bad things could happen. People taking tests during the pandemic performed poorly on simple cognitive tests in comparisons to the pre-pandemic group. Americans in the last wave of test takers showed even slower mental processing speeds than those of the first wave. So he talks about hypnosis. Well, it's easy to be, hypnotized and focus on one small thing and lose the ability to process complex information to piece together something that is commonsensical when, through your own free-floating anxiety, you've lost your capacity to reason, and so you follow in lieu of reason. Tony Fauci is going to bring us to a safe place, for example. Mo in Wilmette, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, Dan. It's an honor to speak with you. And we ran into Amy at Joe Pollack's campaign back in 2010. But the way I fight this wokeness in our educational institutions is to cut them off financially. That's the only way I know how to do it. Mm-hmm. I cut off my private elementary school. I won't say what it is unless you want to know. I cut off my public college, and I cut off my law school. No more donations. That's the only way I know how to deal with them.
That's a good start. Thanks for the call, Mo. I completely agree with that, and I'm in the same camp. I'm open-minded about my grade school, St. Mike's and Wheaton, but not Bennett Academy and Lyle anymore. Certainly not Northwestern, not Loyola Law School. Cindy and Joliet.
Hey, good morning, Dan. Going back to what Governor DeSantis said about the monoclonal antibody shut off, basically, he can't get it. Once that's been discovered that it's a universal, not a cure, but certainly a support, I think that it is a plan. circulation closer to the elections, either the midterm or the presidential elections in 24. And then all of a sudden, the Democratic Party is going to make one sweeping move into the land of the savior. And then the stupid population that elected these morons will be like, oh, well, look what they did. Oh, well, yeah, it's okay. Gas prices went to $6.50 a gallon by then. And I think it's a sociopolitical plan that the Democrats cannot win on merit alone. They have to do scathing, control, Fauciism, germ warfare on the American public to actually stay in office. Because they don't bring anything to the table.
Thanks for the call, Cindy. They don't need germ warfare. They just need the fear of it. That's effective enough, it would seem. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Connect with Dan and Amy on the AM 560 The Answer mobile app. Just text the word app to 64636 to download the app today.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560 The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, the January 6th commission. Their work picks up in earnest in the new year, as we talked about a little bit yesterday with Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano from the Heritage Foundation. Benny Thompson, Democrat Socialist from Mississippi, is the committee chairman. What is going to come of the Jan 6th commission? Well, a couple things he told Clinton Foundation donor Zero. That would be George Stephanopoulos, for those of you scoring your nicknames at home. A couple things. One, legislation. Two, a criminal referral. Particularly the latter matter is problematic, and maybe it's time for House Republican leadership to start paying a little bit more attention to this. And yes, it's illegitimate. Yes, McCarthy didn't get the Republicans he wanted on the commission, so he's been dismissive of it, and it deserves to be largely dismissed. But no, you can't just ignore it and pretend that it doesn't exist. It has to be dealt with head on, particularly when the star chamber that has been assembled is preparing to exceed its constitutional authority. First, Benny Thompson on Never Again, and what form that might take.
Well, the first legislation would be the coordination of resources to protect the Capitol. There were significant inconsistencies in coordination. The National Guard from the District of Columbia was slow to respond, not on its own, but they had to go to the Department of Defense. We had actually fixed that right now, where the mayor of the District of Columbia can access the Guard right now. In addition to that, our intelligence gathering components. As you know, it was clear that we were not apprised that something would happen. But for the most part, it was the worst kept secret in America that people were coming to Washington and the potential for coordination, and what we saw was there. So we want to make sure that never happens again. In addition to that, we want to make sure that the line of communication between the Capitol Police and the structure.
Yeah, so a couple things. One is, yeah, the National Guard. It's interesting you bring that up, Chairman Thompson. Again, it can't be said enough, because it won't be said from the D.C. press corps in providing any pushback to Benny Thompson. They're there to just, again, provide platform. The evidence is that President Trump offered 10,000 National Guardsmen for that day, and that offer was rebuffed. So it seems like it's judgment calls, not structural problems. And in terms of legislation coming out of 1-6, you know, here we go again. Do we learn anything from the excesses of the Patriot Act coming out of 9/11? And I'm not comparing 1-6 to 9/11, as the left does, but I am comparing the opportunity to turn, but by statists, particularly those who are supportive of the surveillance state to take a terrible event that occurred and use that to expand federal power at the expense of the individual citizen. So what form never again might take legislatively is something to be watched closely throughout the process. Secondly, criminal referral. Benny Thompson keeps talking about this, keeps suggesting that they're open to the idea that if they come upon something they determine as criminal, which, by the way, is the entire purpose of this commission, that, you know, he'll be duty bound to make some sort of recommendation to the Department of Justice. Well, actually, no, the Congress and these congressional committees don't have the authority to conduct a criminal investigation. Do not. And yet that seems to be what is afoot.
We all take an oath of office, and part of that is in the pursuit of doing our day-to-day activities. If we find something that is irregular or illegal, we're obligated to report it. So I would say, for the sake of our committee, if in the course of our review we find something that we warrant, that we think warrant review or recommendation to the Department of Defense, Department of Judiciary, Justice, to be honest with you, we'll do it. We are not looking for it, but if we find it,
they're looking
we'll
for
absolutely
it.
Make the referral.
They're looking for something. They're looking for something the FBI hasn't found, have they? He keeps talking in this interview and others about coordination, something the FBI has rejected as a description of what occurred on that day, coordination. And you've got north of 700 people that have been identified and prosecuted for criminal trespass and vandalism and other charges related to the desecration of the Capitol on that day. But the FBI and all the resources at their disposal as an actual law enforcement agency, they haven't come up with anything. But Benny Thompson and his star chamber is going to? Yeah, this is, to me, the sort of pushback, the sort of public questioning that needs to be offered by Kevin McCarthy and House and Senate Republicans if you don't want the Democrat Socialists to further gaslight the American public about what happened on that day and subsequently in advance of the midterms. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by incumbent Republican Congressman Mary Miller from Southern Illinois, who is running for re-election. And with Illinois losing a congressional district, she is one of those Congress people who have been essentially drawn into a district with another Republican, or other Republicans, plural. And she's made a decision about her re-election, which we'll talk about as well. Representative Miller, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Well, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Before we get to your electoral prospects, what about this 1-6 commission? You've got Adam Kinzinger from Illinois, of course, who's going to continue his star turn as the Democrat Socialist favorite Republican next to Liz Cheney when he appears on the Colbert Show this week. And you're hearing what Benny Thompson, the chairman of the commission, is saying. How do you react to that? What's your position on where House Republicans should be on this?
Well, the Democrats, this is a never-ending witch hunt against President Trump because they have no agenda for the American people. They've destroyed our economy. We have this crisis at the border, energy crisis, and this is a continuing 24/7 attack on President Trump and his supporters. My opponent voted for the January 6th commission, and he's close personal friends with Adam Kinzinger and Liz Cheney. I called for them to be removed from the Republican conference, and American people are just weary about this. We're seeing crisis upon crisis, and they're continuing this witch hunt.
Your opponent that you're referring to is incumbent Republican Congressman Rodney Davis. So give us a little bit more in terms of the distinction between the two of you as essentially in that district the primary will be the general election, particularly in this year.
Yeah, well, he's a career politician. He's a liberal Republican, and this is a very conservative district, the Illinois 15, strong pro-life, pro-Second Amendment district, and the constituents don't want a liberal Republican representing them in Congress. I've lived here for over 40 years on a farm. My husband and I raise corn, soybeans, cattle, and kids. We have seven children who we've raised on the farm. I'm fighting Joe Biden's and Nancy Pelosi's agenda in ways that he's on the opposite side of a lot of the issues.
And by the way, I have to add, because I know your family a little bit, and interest of full disclosure, I supported your husband Chris when he ran for state representative. But your daughters are fantastic musicians too, by the way. So congratulations on that. I really enjoy their performances that I've seen online. So let's talk about this a little bit more. The topography of Southern Illinois is such that. You could have run, you don't need to live in a congressional district, just the state in which the district is located. So you could have chosen to run against Mike Bost. You could have chosen to run against Rodney Davis. You chose Rodney Davis. Why?
Because there's more of a contrast between me and him. This is a conservative district, and the people here want a conservative, not just a Republican. And now they have a choice between a Republican or a conservative.
Okay. I wanted to get your reaction to something else. And this is big tech, which is another issue that there's been a lot of time spent in congressional hearings whistling the Zuckerbergs and the Dorseys and the Sundar Pichais before House and Senate committees. But the abuses persist, arguably. The latest being books about Ronald Reagan, Amy Coney Barrett, and Thomas Sowell. Ads for those books were blocked by Facebook. The response from Facebook is it shouldn't have happened. It was an error, and the ad accounts have been restored. By the way, that response comes from a communications person for Meta, Facebook, named Andy Stone, who used to be with Barbara Boxer's office and the DCCC, of course. So we have, you know, the left at the upper reaches of these big tech companies, not just the face people, the principals that everybody knows. And so what should be done? You've had Rand Paul just announce that he is pulling himself off YouTube and he's going to be posting his videos on Rumble instead. Where are you and where is the caucus on big tech in advance of 2022 and 2024, because we were having the same conversation in advance of 2020, the work of Dr. Robert Epstein and others suggesting how much big tech attempts to manipulate information, to manipulate votes, to impact the outcomes of elections.
Yes, this is one of the issues that is causing us to really live in dangerous times. And I know one of my one of the things I was hoping for when President Trump was reelected in 2020 and going forward is that he was going to deal with the Section 230 and the big tech censorship. This is just continuing totalitarianism. And, you know, they deplatform President Trump. And I mean, how long is how much time do we have before they're actually going to say that you can't say we have a baby in the womb? I mean, now they're saying you can't. In fact, the education secretary is sent out a memo to all public schools in the United States saying that if you say there's two genders, you're guilty of harassment, which is putting teachers on the hot spot to be fired or students to be disciplined. This is totalitarianism. We have to deal with this.
Yeah, and it's remarkable. I saw a study or a survey out over the holidays. 75% of Americans believe that there are only two sexes, male and female. but 75% is not winning. the fact that a quarter of the population doesn't believe that biological truth should be frightening in terms of an understanding of where we're going. I mean, if you asked that question a decade ago, I suspect it would have been about 99% believe that. So, and with only a quarter believing that, three quarters not believing that, still that side of the discussion dominates our civic and cultural institutions.
It's true, and I think that this is showing the importance of regular people like myself to get involved and stand up, to have courage and fight back.
With respect to the election, in addition to decrying those things you started our conversation with about what the mm-hmm. Biden administration has done and what we see the Democrat socialists doing culturally too, what is it that the Republican Party, what is it that you're going to run on in addition to running against? What is the Republican Party, the vision that should be put forward by conservative Republicans like yourself?
Well, actually, I was just talking to Jim Jordan and some of the other members about what our priorities should be. And this is one of the things that we brought up that should be our priority is dealing with Section 230. That and then, what's happened with the January 6th and how the federal government has been weaponized against the American people. Very scary. We are living in dangerous times. We don't need to elect people that are going to be passive. We need people like regular people to speak up. And I really want to encourage people to get involved on the state and local level also.
You mentioned President Trump. President Trump, this is one of these primary campaigns he's decided to wade into. He has endorsed your election over Rodney Davis. What does that mean? How should people interpret President Trump's endorsement of you in this primary campaign?
Yes, I'm very honored to have his endorsement. He is selective on who he endorses. He endorsed me because I'm the true America First candidate and not part of the D.C. swamp. Last summer, I was able to spend some time with President Trump when we toured the southern border together. And I'm grieving that he's not in office right now. China's laughing at us. They see nothing but weakness and incompetence out of the Biden White House. And for the American people, they're suffering. We're just layering crisis upon crises. And when I talk to people, they're scared, actually.
She is Mary Miller. She is an incumbent congresswoman. She's running for re-election in a primary campaign against incumbent Republican Congressman Rodney Davis. For more information on her candidacy, MaryMillerForCongress.com, MaryMillerForCongress.com. Congresswoman Miller, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. She joined us on the Turnkey.pro answer line.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Mike Manapkin runs the Democratic House floor. For 30-plus years running, he's promising this and he's stealing that. Where can you get that kind of money? He's using your house like his own piggy bank. Gang. You ought to know by now. You can pay off your house here in Illinois, but you can never keep up with the taxes. Oh, how it's always been the plan to have a taxpayer pay no doubt. Not a matter of if anymore, but when you're moving out. I said, when you're moving out.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Amy is sick today, so hopefully she'll get well soon and be back in short order. Time for that theme music means it's time for our weekly confab with Ted Dabrowski, the president at WirePoints.com, all things Illinois policy related. And let's start with an Illinois policy from way back in 2021, a year ago, a little less. You may remember the landmark criminal justice reform package that Governor Jelly Belly signed into law that would phase out the use of cash bail, making Illinois among the first states to do so, eliminating cash bail. That doesn't get fully phased out until January of 23, but it's in process. And there were other matters too, pretrial detention relaxations, sentencing relaxations, of course, the imposition of what they call more accountability with respect to police. It was really more liability exposure for police related to the conduct of their professional responsibilities. Hailed by the Black Caucus, despite opposition from law enforcement, police unions. Mm-hmm. So just thinking about that at the state level, because I know we think of crime control and public safety as mainly a local issue, and it is, but the state still has some impact. Let's go back to the case that we discussed in some detail yesterday. The police officer who was murdered in Bradley, Illinois, Sergeant Ritmanic, and her partner, Tyler Bailey, who took a gunshot wound to the head and is in critical condition, last reported. And the individuals who have been arrested in connection with the murder of the one officer and the shooting of the other, particularly the 25-year-old man. He's been arrested 21 times and charged 43 different times with various crimes around Kankakee County over the past 7 years. 21 times arrested in 7 years in Kankakee County, known quantity. His crimes included felony burglary, residential burglary, felony possession of a stolen firearm, felony criminal damage to government property, misdemeanor theft, resisting a peace officer. Cited 10 times for driving without a valid driver's license, 8 times for driving without auto insurance. Many of those cases were still open with the court, several active warrants for his arrest. Most recently, a warrant was issued for this guy's arrest in July of last year after he failed to appear in court to face a May 5th misdemeanor battery charge in Bradley. In April, he was cited by Illinois State Police for driving on a suspended license without insurance and with marijuana in the car. He was not asked to post cash bond, promised to appear. Didn't show up for court. Then a warrant was issued for his arrest. In February, so a couple months earlier, cited by Bourbonnais police for driving on a suspended license without vehicle registration or insurance. Was not asked to post cash bond. Promised to appear. Did not show up for court. A familiar story, unfortunately, in Illinois. Usually it's in the context of Chicago, but it's not limited to Chicago. There are other mid-sized communities around the state that have serious violence problems as well, and you know, and on a per capita basis, some approaching the problems that we document routinely in Chicago. So now, in the wake of this officer's murder, and as more information becomes available about the criminal justice system in Kankakee County, like the criminal justice system in Illinois, informed by criminal justice reforms at the state level. Now, do we have the issue of crime finally arrive at Governor Jellybelly's well-appointed doorstep? Well, let's put that question to Ted Dabrowski. Ted, thanks for joining us, as always. Appreciate it.
Hey, Dan. Happy New Year, and sorry to hear Amy sick.
Yeah, what about a Happy New Year to you? And what about this? You know, we talk about Chicago police and talk about the mayor and we talk about suburban communities that are hit. And then we have something so devastating and savage as what occurred with respect to these two police officers in Bradley. And it's at least in part informed by what's happening at the state level, which permeates the entire state. So what about a Governor Pritzker's responsibility here?
Yeah, you know, we remember when all those laws were being passed a year ago and they were hailing them as these fantastic reforms. But, you know, I remember probably 4 or 5 years ago when this stuff started taking hold and we had all kinds of these criminal justice reforms. And, you know, they sound good on paper because, you know, if you don't know the facts, and most people don't know the facts and the facts aren't out there, that while it sounds like we're protecting people from, you know, what we don't want to do is put in, you know, young people who do some small offense and then they become, you know, put them behind bars and then they become, you know, lifelong criminals. And that's kind of the argument that's being used. But what we're forgetting is that, you know, a lot of these people are criminals. And we've
and lifelong ones and lifelong ones by the age of 25.
Well, yeah, I mean, you look at the rap sheets of some of these people. So, you know, we've confused what should be, you know, smart policing, smart prosecution with, you know, I hate to use the word here, but, you know, woke prosecution. And so we have, you know, bastardized the prosecution process. We bastardized the policing process to where we have a person like the one you just mentioned. Look at all the things that have gone wrong. We're hearing these stories across the country, right, where people who have horrible records are out there, you know, sometimes on, you know, with the ankle bracelet, and they're perpetrating more crimes and killing people. And so we're not going to look at it now. I can tell you that we're not going to look at these laws anytime soon to unwind them. But that, because it's just not going to happen, especially this year, which is an election year. But you're going to start to hear people complain more and more because we already heard, I guess, the San Francisco mayor already start to go backwards. London, I can't think of her last
London
name.
London Breed, yeah.
Yeah, thanks. You know, start to speak in terms that are the opposite of what she was saying before. Much like you were saying about Lightfoot and COVID, the outcomes, the results are so ludicrous that they're going to have to eat some of their words and try to figure out how to walk back some of this. But
well, right,
it's not going to happen soon.
And I expect from Jelly Belly, you'll hear the same thing you heard from Triple Threat, which is more federal resources. We're working with the federal, blah 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 blah. So they don't have to address what they are or are not doing at the state and local level. I mean, again, you're right. There's no pressure being felt by the power structure as it's currently constituted in Illinois to consider changes to the law. But there could be political pressure applied if there was the interest to do so, including at the gubernatorial level.
Well, there should be tons of pressure. I mean, maybe the number one thing that I'm hearing and seeing from people is, you know, parent control of schools and crime. And, you know, it's rampant now. But I think you're right, and you hit it on the spot, what they're going to do, both Pritzker and Lightfoot, is just say, here are these new $200 million programs, $400 million programs. We're going to address root causes. They're going to do all that kind of stuff when in fact, the first thing you do when you have a problem is you got to stop the leak. You got to stop the crisis, and then you focus on root problems, but root causes. But they're just going to throw money. It's an election year. They're going to try to look good about it, and look what they're doing, and look how much they care.
And meanwhile, we had another six figures worth of Illinoisans flee the state in 2021. This is sort of an annual ritual at this point. So you know, people aren't waiting around for things to change. They're going to go places where things are different.
Well, yeah, we always talk about the exogenous factors that bring down Illinois and finally lead to change eventually, God knows when. But it's got to be population. If it's not some weird thing or some massive Chicago, you know, problem, it's going to be that continuous drip of people. And it's not a drip. You know, this amount that was published by the census for the last year, 114,000 people left. That's almost 1% of the population, and you know, you hate to think of it as a Puerto Rico thing where, you know, each year it's a little bit more to where suddenly the numbers become big enough that they matter. But, you know, when you lose 114,000 people in 1 year, it's the second most on a percentage basis in the country. That's the signal that things aren't working, you know, across the board, on top of being one of just three states to shrink in the last decade. So I don't want to call it the wake-up call. That's the actual thing. Watch out for that. If it increases again in 2022, you know, given that we're going to do more mandates, the vaccine mandates, just watch out. That's the one to watch out for.
You recounted this anecdote, a conversation you had with a successful entrepreneur who went west, young man, left Illinois, and why he did so at wire points in this piece. And I loved his, even though it's not exactly spot on, I loved his metaphor for Illinois, Cloaca Maxima, referring to one of the world's first sewer systems in ancient Rome. But what he told you why, as to why he left?
Well, yeah, you know, this is a guy who you know, I got to know a little bit, not a lot, but I certainly, you can read about him if you knew who he was, and you could Google him. You know, pretty engaged. You know, he took on the politicians. He got involved in races. He got involved in talking about and writing about the finances of the city and the state. You know, he wasn't shying away from getting engaged, and he just got sick of it because he said, I got nothing done, or I wasn't getting enough done. Things were going the wrong way, and so he told me he didn't use the word sewer. He said the Illinois was in the you know what, and then he said, you know, it's already cloaca maxima. But he was fed up, and you know, this is a guy who's you know very wealthy, funded companies, funded races. You know, he was a guy that cared, and you know, ticked off enough that he left. And this is the tax erosion, tax base erosion. We're going to see if you know, not if this continues, as it continues.
Now, cloaca maxima, though, that was a modern marvel of human innovation. The closest thing that we have is like the burn interchange, which I think is taking longer than cloaca maxima took to build.
Well, you know, the scary part is that the numbers are very big. You know, we at WirePoints, we looked at the IRS data, the people that IRS tracks who moves where every year and how much money they take with them, what their incomes are, and, you know, the size of their families by naming the dependents on the tax return. And, you know, we lose on net 3,000 to 6,000 of these wealthy people that make 200,000 or more each year. And those numbers add up, and it's why we lose something like $5 to $6 billion a year of taxable income to other states. We're one of the biggest losers, if not the biggest, the second biggest loser in the country, to people leaving and taking their money with them.
I was talking to an estate planning attorney who's with one of the bigger firms in Chicago, and he also has a sizable book of business, but just one. A somewhat prominent estate planning attorney at one firm in Chicago, he said his firm is seeing $100 million worth of net worth in terms of their clients leaving Illinois every month. I mean, you know, so just to try to get a hand, the numbers are so big, to try to get a handle on a little bit of a smaller number and just think about extrapolating from there the sort of wherewithal that is leaving the state.
Yeah, and then there's the other side of the equation. Who's not coming in? You know, the more that people figure out that this place is heading towards bankruptcy, why would you move here? Unless, of course, you know, unless it's, you know, what Pritzker's doing and you know, promoting Illinois as a sanctuary state, then we're attracting people who don't make that much money and are less productive than the ones we're losing. So net-net, we're just becoming a poorer state as well. So, you know, the population might kind of hang in there because we bring in, you know, immigrants and you know, some legal, some illegal, but certainly we get poor as a state, and our ability to fund the things that a lot of the people want won't be there.
Well, and also too, you know, the affordability piece of it. I mean, in addition, you know, so affordability isn't an issue for some of the high profile people, the rich people who leave, and that's significant. But also just sort of the upwardly mobile, the middle income folks, the people who play by the rules. The United Van Lines survey is out again in 2021. The largest net gains in terms of, you know, from United Van Lines, people moving two states, Vermont, South Dakota, South Carolina, West Virginia, and Florida. The bottom five states, New Jersey, Illinois, New York, Connecticut, California. What does that distribution tell you?
Geez, and you know, the whole census data is also, if you take the top 10 states that want all the people, that want all the wealth, you know, they're winning the competition for people and their money compared to the bottom 10. It's really, you know, red states that are open. You know, you can kind of correlate it to COVID and all that stuff. Red states that are open, low tax, versus the blue states that are oppressive and high tax and, you know, want to tell you what to do every day.
He is Ted Dabrowski, president of WirePoints, wirepoints.com, all things Illinois policy related. Ted, thanks as always. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Dan.
Join us on the turnkey.pro answer line.
This is the morning show. More Chicago radio listeners are choosing. This is Chicago's morning answer on AM 560. The answer. This is Chicago's morning answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Amy off sick today, so she'll get well soon. We're confident. Yesterday, Creepshow Joe had a little summit to take on Big Meat. Yeah, Big Meat. Of course, we all are seeing what's happening at grocery stores in terms of the prices of food. Fine cuts of meat up 30% year over year. All grocery prices increasing about a little less than 7% in total, according to some reporting. That far outpaces that 2.8% increase in wages last year, doesn't it? Mm. And Joe Biden claims it's price gouging by Big Meat that is to blame. That's what he had to say yesterday.
In too many industries, a handful of giant companies dominate the market. And too often, they use their power to squeeze out smaller competitors and stifle new entrepreneurs, making our economy less dynamic, and giving themselves free rein to raise prices, reduce options for consumers, or exploit workers. The meat industry is a textbook example on the price side. Four big corporations control more than half of the markets in beef, pork, and poultry. These middlemen that they buy from, farmers and ranchers, and sell the processors, sell the processed product to grocery stores. That's the way it works. Without meaningful competition, farmers and ranchers don't get to choose who they sell to. Or put another way, our farmers and ranchers have to pay whatever these four big companies say they have to pay, by and large. But that's only half of it. These companies can use their position as middlemen to overcharge grocery stores and ultimately families. If we can hold a second, I was telling my colleagues earlier in my office that I was sitting in my kitchen yesterday, and there's a sunroom off the kitchen, and my wife was there with her sister and a good friend named Mary Ann, and she was saying, do you realize it's over $5 for a pound of hamburger meat? $5? Well, this is partly, you know, the pound of beef today costs $5 compared to less than $4 before the pandemic.
Mm-hmm. And it's because of price gouging.
I've said it before and I'll say it again. Capitalism without competition isn't capitalism. It's exploitation. Mm-hmm. That's what we're seeing in meat and poultry, in those industries now.
Mm-hmm. The big meat is exploiting people. So this consolidation in the industries, this happened just recently? The four companies that control more than half of the beef, pork, and poultry markets, they just established that dominance recently? And that's what it, and so the price increases are explained by their collusion to gouge? Huh. Really? Another perspective comes from friend of the show, friend of mine, Jeffrey Carter. Writes about this over his Substack, jeffreycarter.substack.com. He traded lean hogs for a while at the Mercantile Exchange in Chicago. And when he was in that market, he tried to understand the fundamentals of what it made it tick. So he talked to factory farmers and so forth. He asks the question that is posed by Joe Biden, gives a bit of a different answer, though. He writes, why is the state of competition, or why is this the state of competition in the meat industry? You can look at two agencies in the federal bureaucracy, the FDA and USDA. They're rife with anti-competitive regulations that incentivize the centralization of production. It's financially impossible to economically build a new slaughterhouse to increase competition. Combine the doofuses at the FDA and USDA with 50 different states that each have their own state regulators for farming and processing, and you've laid out a minefield for companies to try and get food from the field to your plate. Wisconsin, for example, heavily regulates the dairy industry. It's impossible to innovate. You want beautiful cheeses like they have in France? No can do with the way the dairy industry is regulated in the United States. It extends to what farmers can plant as well. The USDA regulates how much one crop gets planted, price supports, and in most crops there are price subsidies. Of course, this manipulates the marketplace. Americans wind up paying higher costs than they should with all this government intervention. Another interesting undercurrent in the meat markets, and we see this most notably in California, environmentalists hate factory farming. yet they want cheap meat. Except you can't have it both ways. In California, the socialists changed the rules on pork production, which is increasing the cost of pork to everyone. And in addition to that, in terms of other costs of doing business not contemplated by our president there, you have the CEO and president of a fertilizer giant named Yara International warning, I want to say this loud and clear right now. We are at risk of a very low crop in the next harvest. I'm afraid we're going to have a food crisis. He's worried about the rising cost of energy and especially of natural gas, which is needed to make ammonia and key fertilizer components. He writes, people and industries of all kinds are feeling the shocks. Among farmers and ranchers, very few topics are being discussed as much as the skyrocketing cost of fertilizer and increasing concerns regarding availability, reports the American Farm Bureau. And so the disruption of supply chains, government regulation, government market manipulation, and government regulation in the energy industry, which is increasing the cost to produce the goods that are needed to do the farming. Maybe all of that has something to do with skyrocketing prices, in addition to the labor supply shortage created by these same people, these same central planners, pursuing their same follies. Maybe that has something to do with this as well. Maybe it's not just this alleged consolidation in the meat industries that Joe Biden would have you believe happened overnight on his watch, and he wants to do something about it, like more price controls. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined again by Andy Puzder, senior fellow at the Pepperdine University School of Public Policy, former CEO of the CKE Restaurants, and author of Getting America Back to Work and It's Time to Let America Work Again. Andy, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Great to be here, Dan. Thank you.
So is it Joe Biden who's correct that it's these evil big meat CEOs who are price gouging Ma and Pa America, or is it actually government policies that have brought us to this place and then exacerbated it in the last 2 years, and that is the proximate cause of the price spikes?
You know, there's so much wrong with what Joe Biden said in the segment you played that it would take a couple of your shows to go through it all. I mean, first of all, I'm absolutely in favor of anything that we can do that will make American businesses more competitive. And as you pointed out, the major thing that you could do is make it possible for small businesses to operate. If small businesses can't operate, they can't compete with large businesses if they have huge expenses incurred to comply with government regulations. So if you've got to have a legal staff, or if you've got to hire outside counsel and accountants and advisors to get through the bureaucracy to run your business. If you're a big business, you can afford that. If you're a small business, you're not even going to make the effort. So if he wants to cut back on the extent to which government's involved in American businesses and harmfully involved, I'm not saying they shouldn't be involved at all, but to the extent that American businesses are overregulated, if he wants to do what President Trump did and significantly reduce regulation, then God bless him. I'll go for that. But think about what he said for a minute. What he said was there are four large meat suppliers who dominate 50% of the market. Well, let me say that differently. There are 50% of the market is dominated by small businesses. You've got 50% of the meat market with people competing with each other, and you've got four large meat suppliers also competing with each other to try and grow their market share. So you've got four large suppliers and a number of smaller suppliers that control 100% of the market. And the only way that they can increase their share in the market is by, one, selling more product, which requires either better quality, better service, or lower prices. So you have competition. We have a lot of competition with respect to people that are supplying meat to the market. The problem isn't that we don't have competition. I mean, obviously, these four are competing with each other, and they're competing with the smaller suppliers. The problem is the expenses of running those businesses have surged under the Biden administration because, one, people aren't working. If you don't have people to sow the fields or harvest the crops or take care of the livestock, you're going to slaughter your cattle if you don't have people to help you take care of them. But when you do that, you have to sell them. That's going to drive, that normally would drive prices down initially, but once the cattle out there, that's going to drive the price up. And that's where we are today. We're at a point where there aren't enough cows. There isn't enough feed. There's not going to be enough fertilizer. And if he addresses this problem by trying to attack American businesses that are already competing to try and provide good prices, good quality, good service to their customers and to consumers, then he's going to exacerbate this problem, which is exactly what happens whenever government collectivists, people like Biden and the Democrats that are now running our government, are in control. This is what you end up with. You end up with bad decisions on a collective basis, which would have been really dealt with much better by the businesses that are actually involved in this process. So just virtually, I can't think of anything that Biden said with which I agree, other than the prices are way up. He has no idea why they're up, and he has no idea how to get them down.
Well, right, and there's also sort of the arbitrariness of it, right? He's very concerned, as is the left, about consolidation in the meat industry, not so much the tech industry. He's very concerned about big oil, not so concerned about big banks. It's all very constituency-driven, isn't it?
It is, and like, you know, you and his underlying assumptions are just generally just so wrong. How can you solve a problem that you don't understand? And this is a guy who's been in government all his life. He's surrounded by Keynesian economists who, if it works on a spreadsheet, they think it works in the real world. He doesn't have people around him who have actually functioned in the real world, and he's making terrible decisions.
Well, and the other matter here, too, and you touched upon it, is labor supply. And this is a guy who also believes the government can set wages by fiat. And so $15 minimum wages or subsidizing people to not work, as we went through last year for an extended period of time. And of course, those costs are passed on to the consumer as well, whether it's at the grocery store or at a restaurant.
That's absolutely right. And by the way, you know, the $15 minimum wage today would be meaningless. I mean, you can't find a place
right
that isn't hiring people for $14, $15, $16 an hour. So, America, you got the $15 minimum wage. How do you like what it's doing to prices at the grocery store? How do you like what it's doing for prices at a restaurant or at a Costco? Prices are up everywhere because if you increase labor costs and there's high demand for products but low supply, you're going to end up with significant price increases. And this is what we're seeing. You mentioned it earlier. We've had now 7 months in a row where the rate of inflation has exceeded the rate of wage growth. We've got tremendous wage growth, but everything costs more. So wages are worthless. It's the difference between what they call, economists refer to as nominal wages and real wages. Your nominal wages are the number on your paycheck. The real wages are what they're worth. And even though the paycheck's gotten bigger, the number's higher, like everybody wanted to see, in fact, it's worth less. And that's what happens when the government tries to interfere on a broad basis with specific aspects of the economy. You know, it's like pushing on a balloon. You push in one place, something's got to pop out. Pressure moves somewhere else. The economy isn't something that the government can solve, you know, one little item at a time. This wage increase is really hitting people hard.
I wanted to get your take as a former CEO of a significant restaurant group. Of course, like New York, like L.A., Chicago and Cook County have now gone to vax pass mandates, so you can't go to a restaurant unless you show proof of vaccination. Mayor Lightfoot of Chicago said she is hearing from businesses thank yous, plaudits from businesses, because this will ensure they have a safe environment for their patrons. Is that your sense of how restaurateurs and other businesses will react to this?
No, the restaurateurs wanted to make sure that they had a safe environment. There's nobody stopping them from checking to see whether people have been vaccinated. This isn't something that the government had to require. You certainly have the right to ask people if they've been vaccinated, to make them show you their vaccination cards when they go in. So businesses would have been choosing this on their own if they thought this was the way to drive business and to make sure that their customers were safe. Now, I live in Tennessee, and you know, nobody here has asked me to see my vaccination card since I was first vaccinated last January, a year ago. So and I went to New York, and of course every restaurant I went to, you had to show your vaccine card, every gym. And we're really not having the same kind of problems here in Tennessee that they're having up in New York with respect to the spread of this Omicron. And I realize it's going to spread everywhere. We're probably all going to get it at one point or another. But I don't really see how forcing people to produce a card to get into a restaurant when they don't even have to produce anything to vote, according to the Democrats, is somehow fair, equitable, and going to improve the business environment or get inflation under control or really accomplish any other goal.
He is Andy Puzder, senior fellow at the Pepperdine University School of Public Policy, former CEO of CKE Restaurants, and author of Getting America Back to Work, as well as It's Time to Let America Work Again. Andy, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
And great to be here, Dan. Thank you.
Andy joined us on the turnkey.pro answer line.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning. My dream is coming true, or at least the possibility is enhanced. A good piece by Kristen Tate, who's a libertarian writer over at The Hill. For more than a decade, Democrats worked to build a voting base composed of minorities and unmarried women. After Trump's 2020 loss, it would appear the mission was being accomplished. White voters dropped from 81% of the electorate in 2000 to just 67% two decades later. In 2020, Biden carried 63% of single women. However, that coalition they thought they had cemented is fracturing under this president and the Democrat Socialists. In February, 70% of Hispanic voters supported Biden, February of last year. By November, that was below 50%. Early polling for the 2022 midterms, as we've discussed on this show previously, Hispanic voters are split evenly, 37-37 between the two major parties, generic ballot test, in terms of their congressional preferences. And in swing states, like, say, Florida, it's completely capsized, in Arizona, too, where black and Hispanic voters helped deliver Florida for Ron DeSantis, for Doug Ducey in Arizona, mainly Hispanic voters there, and for President Trump in Florida as well. She describes, obviously, the policies that we've talked a lot about, but particularly the attitude of the movers in the Democrat Socialist Party, the so-called Karens, if you will. Not that I like that term very much, but just as a handle. Talking about white leftist women. Predominantly single women, but not exclusively. A lot of, you know, married women who have male impersonators as husbands, too. Among black voters, Biden's approval has fallen from 85% early in 21 to 67% by the last quarter of last year. So that's significant attrition. And why the decline? Well, the decline is obvious. The pocketbook issues, the education of their children, just like anybody else, they're seeing their quality of life and the quality of life they're able to provide for their children decline under these Democrat socialists that treat them like mascots, that behave towards them like they have some white leftist woman's burden to run their lives for them. One of the better examples is this terminology, Latinx, which has been rejected by LULAC, which is a left-wing Latino advocacy organization, because it's been rejected by Latinos, generally speaking, in the country. So this is potentially the new coalition of working people, middle-income people, people who play by the rules, is the term I like to use, which is transcends race and, frankly, net worth and gender and every other non-behavioral characteristic. And that is a majority coalition in this country. Maybe not in Chicago, maybe not in big cities, but it is in America. And if you want to see the script flipped in D.C., in 22 with an eye towards 24, then this is the path. As I've said for many moons, I would happily trade a black voters on the west or south side of Chicago for these repugnant leftist women in the North Shore, in West Cook County, places like Hoke Park and River Forest, in Hinsdale and Naperville and elsewhere. These ghastly suburban women, single, divorced, married, leftist is the key. She writes persuasively that the increasingly vapid demands of the urbane upper middle class often harm the communities that liberals claim to help. NIMBYism drives up housing prices for minority residents. Defund the police rhetoric has led to major cuts in law enforcement as violent crime soars and quality of life declines. Families in cities like Chicago, which has experienced more murders in 21 since any year since 96, are forced to live with shootings that occur routinely in public areas. In some cases, young children have been killed by flying bullets. Yeah, no kidding. And these women with their hate has no home signs in their yards, henpecking people at grocery stores to pull their mask up over their mouth and their nose, is repelling black and Latino voters as much as it repels me. Yay! 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. It seems to me one of the messaging paths over the next 10 months is to focus on these intolerant, ignorant, shrill, man-hating harridans in the suburbs and say to everyone else, they are not with us. They are with the Democrat Socialists. They are the Democrat Socialists. It is their party. And so you may have qualms about us built up over decades of propagandizing from, well, the Democrat Socialists, from all the institutions they control that have such cultural sway. But take a hard look at your choice and make that relatively easy decision as to whom you would like to align yourself with. Let me give you an example. It's happening in real time. Providing medical care based on race. This is in New York, but it's not limited to New York. New York City's the state's departments of health issue new guidelines rationing oral antiviral medications and the one monoclonal antibody preparation that's effective against Omicron so as to instruct providers to consider race and ethnicity and give preference to those who are BIPOC, Black, Indigenous, People of Color. By the way, another acronym or phrase that is rejected by most BIPOCs who are not, sort of lobotomized leftists like these ghastly leftist suburban women I'm talking about, and rich women in urban areas, too. The city's health advisory in New York directs providers to adhere to the State Department of Health prioritization guidance, and the providers are asked to consider whether patients are immunocompromised, their age, their vaccine status, comorbidities, and race. All other risk factors such as age, immune, and vaccination status being equal, non-white and Hispanic Latino patients will be granted superior treatment access compared with whites. So you can call this affirmative action for medical care, but it's much more pernicious than that. And this is, I don't think, mainly being driven by BIPOCs, at least those that don't have shows on MSNBC or CNN or aren't in the Academy. It's being driven by these white leftist women who purport to speak for and on behalf of minority families in this country. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. I mean, consider this. You're talking about infusing race where it has no place. We know what the rank order prioritization should be for scarce resources. Number one, per our conversation earlier in the show about Ron DeSantis's commentary, monoclonal antibodies, central planning is part of the problem why they're so scarce. But to the extent there's a prioritization, we know that the greatest indicator of COVID risk is what? Age, not race. And then other matters like comorbidities. Remember early on in the pandemic, too, this was like COVID is racist, because initially you were seeing more hospitalizations and deaths among minorities as a percentage of the population as compared to whites. Well, ultimately, over time, as the virus spread and we gained a better understanding of it, those differences leveled out, and you could separate race out because it wasn't a leading indicator, other than there was a higher correlation of comorbidities with particular races. But that's a commentary on the quality of life where a disproportionate share of minorities live, places that are not safe, like the west and south sides of Chicago and other urban centers, for example, which is in part explains the discrepancy in life expectancy. I've mentioned this before many times. The largest discrepancy in life expectancy in anywhere in the country, in one city, is in Chicago, between the residents of Streeterville, where I live, and the residents of Inglewood. Average life expectancy in Streeterville, 90. Average life expectancy in Inglewood, 60. And it has nothing to do with COVID, because it was the case before COVID. So the more they push race, not just critical race theory in schools, but when it comes to healthcare, when it comes to everything, I think you're seeing more people of color, BIPOCs, if you will, to use their vernacular, reject that and also see through the patronizing approach that these white leftists, particularly women, and again, the geldings that they're married to in some cases, see through their what they promise in terms of their stewardship and what they're actually delivering, which is dependency and a reduced quality of life via that dependency. Now, it's not going to be, you're not going to go from 90% of black voters voting for the Democrat Socialists to winning that constituency in one election cycle. But this is why it behooves conservatives, Republicans, regardless of color, to take on these identitarians straight away. Because if they're challenged, and if what they're doing is exposed and detailed and understood, it's a dead bang loser still in this country. That's the hope I have for 22 and beyond. Kevin in Austin, Texas.
Hey, love you taking up this topic. There's a great book that I think everybody should read. It's called Invisible Man by Ralph Emerson Ellison.
Yeah.
Probably familiar at 1953. And that details exactly what they've been doing. You know, I feel so sorry for these people. Let me assuage my white guilt because I have all these things. And how condescending and patronizing they are. And they're actually just using them for votes. So I think that should be required reading for everybody. And the other thing is, if these people that are involved, I say this a lot when I call it, get involved in the precinct level of the GOP and take it over. So the people that are involved in the GOP in Illinois aren't continuing to control it, because the leadership is playing the same game.
Thanks for the call, Kevin. Nick, and good recommendation on Invisible Man by Ellison. Nick on the Northwest side.
Yes, hello. Happy New Year to the absent. She's absent today, right?
Yeah, she's out sick. She'll be back.
In my heart, though. Anyhow, Happy New Year. So I was saying that I worked for 44 years. I've never been on welfare or unemployment. I'm retired now for 10 years. A couple of times I tried to get a Medicaid card because I do qualify for example, the ride free permit for public transportation. And I know I would qualify for it. I go to with all my paperwork and to get for some dental stuff and just at the dental college, okay, at U of I Dental College. And I get a runaround that, we got to check it again. And they end up paying like $75 to have a tooth pulled out and $75 for an x-ray out of my pocket. And it luckily, I don't have to go that often because I got some of my teeth gone already. But still, it's not fair to me. And I'd like to say that the average black and brown person, though, is not the one pushing for this. It's these leaders and sometimes the white leaders thinking that they represent something wholly the way they're going about this. They're pushing this kind of stuff. And all it does is create friction between people. It's like stirring a pot, you know what I mean, throwing gasoline on a fire, whatever you want to say. It just makes people antagonistic to each other. But thanks otherwise, that's it. So.
Thanks for the call, Nick. Appreciate it. Wouldn't it be just delicious if the race hustlers actually ended up producing a more colorblind society because more black and brown people came over to the conservative ranks? Talk about being hoist by your own petard. Holly in St. Louis.
Hey, Happy New Year, Dan. I would like to say that it's going to be very important for us to keep the American dream alive, because what these white socialists, they've made it, right? So they have to convince people who haven't made it that making it isn't that great and they're down with the struggle, either for guilt or whatever reason. And I've always preached to my kids accomplishment over entitlement. And during the 2020 riots, we happened to be in Nashville. We pulled in, our hotel was boarded up. It was a big march that day, and the hotel said there's one restaurant down near Broadway that's open, a high-end taco joint. And so we walked down there, and we had to walk to get seated by a very well-dressed, smart-looking black family. And they had to sit there and carry on. Obviously, they had made the American dream, while protesters shamed them. So that seems to me to be the key, is to rob all these people of the American dream and sell them entitlement as the new American dream. And we have to keep the American dream of accomplishment over entitlement alive.
Thanks for the call, Holly. Deborah, Arlington Heights.
Hey, Dan. Happy New Year. I think a lot of it is virtue signaling and feeling morally superior. And, not, you know, if people would teach equality and personal responsibility and justice as opposed to blaming somebody else, equity and social justice, which are big problems, there's a huge difference. You know, we could, you know, start to solve this problem, but what's happening is just disgraceful.
Yeah, thanks for the call. But I think there's still a lot of people that are afraid to confront race straight away, even who know better and the conservative ranks and probably candidates for office. You need to do it. And you should be encouraged to do it because it's a winner. Dan and Amy, Chicago's Morning Answer.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.